Rachel Gunn RN was a show. This early 90s comedy featured the most unprofessional hospital staff in television history, a lot of former Chippendales guys, an inexplicable amount of dancing, and Batman before he was Batman. Tune in as Bryn, Aaron, and Barry try to diagnose this ill-fated sitcom. Cold Open. We grew up during peak sitcom. Seinfeld, Friends, The Fresh Prince. But those shows were diamonds in the rough. This podcast is not about those diamonds. It's about the rough. Some sitcoms were briefly popular in their time. Some were canceled almost immediately. You probably won't recognize most of these, and you'll ask, that was a show?
That was a show?
The podcast about failed or forgotten sitcoms from the 80s and 90s, starring
Bryn Burney,
Aaron Yeager,
and Andrew Helmer as Barry.
A Radio Gizmo production. Hey, folks, we're back.
Welcome to episode 32 of That Was a Show. Hi, Bryn. Hi, Barry.
Hi.
Hello.
We've got a lot to talk about today.
We do.
Yes,
we
indeed
do.
Indeed, we do.
Perhaps before we get into our show of choice, we could speak for a brief moment about some very sad news that came this past week.
Yeah, it was a rough go. We lost the great comedian Norm Macdonald this week, and I gotta say, like a lot of people this week, I've spent a lot of time just watching Norm Macdonald clips. Yeah, it was really sad. He's a big influence on me, like in terms of comedy, and also just as an adult, like I just occasionally just always turn to him for like random laughs when I was having a bad week. So
yeah, absolutely.
His humor was so specific. Like his whole shtick was, it always killed me. It always
incredibly unique.
Yeah,
I mean,
didn't I go on a rant about his moth joke like two episodes ago?
You did. And it's another case that's like very sad about, you know, people in the public eye who have kept their like long illnesses from, you know, from everybody. Not that it's anyone's business, but it's also like, I feel like a lot of people were shocked because we didn't know that he had cancer.
Yeah, and it's indicative of the fact that a lot of people clearly don't feel safe being open about certain things in our society.
Yeah.
And that's not
he always, at least from, you know, what you glean from him, I mean, he has that great quote about cancer, whereas like, you know, if you lose your life to cancer, you know, the cancer dies at the same time. So that's not a lose, it's a draw. And I love that.
Oh, wow.
And like,
wow.
But he also, I think he was the kind of guy who like, he didn't want that to be the conversation. Like,
right.
He never stopped doing what he was doing. He never stopped trying to make people laugh. And I think, you know, when we find ourselves attached to celebrities, we feel like maybe we're owed a part of their personal life. But
yeah,
the fact of the matter is we aren't.
We are not.
No, not at all. It's weird. What, especially with the internet, like the level of, you know, like these parasocial relationships really, really run deep. Like, it's a very odd phenomenon. But I feel like somebody like Norm Macdonald, he's just been like in our lives since we were kids, you know? So it feels personal and it feels like, you know, you want to know.
This one hurt, man.
And
this
as Canadians, he was a very proud Canadian. And although he worked a lot in the United States and that's where he probably became most famous, he always kind of returned to Canada from time to time to do certain things here. And on that note, back in 2016, I got to attend the Canadian Screen Awards. I won't go into any further detail on why, because I don't want to make this about me, but I bring this up purely just because Norm Macdonald was hosting.
Right. Oh my God, I forgot.
Fantastic.
It was so good. It was like a highlight of our.
He was such a great awards show host. Like incredible. And the one thing I also distinctly remember, Bryn was there with me.
Yeah.
I distinctly remember that he pitched the idea that Canadian Screen Awards be called Candies, named after John Candy.
Oh.
The way that the American Academy are called, like colloquially, Oscars, that we could call them Candies. I don't think that took off, unfortunately, but he got a really good response from the audience on the day for proposing the idea.
It was a big one. It was a big one. And I'm sure we all floated the idea of covering one of Norm's shows, but it's too soon.
Too soon.
I don't want to dig into it.
Yeah. At some point we will. But
I'll also mention that if anyone wants to hear a little bit more about kind of like an intimate perspective on what it was like working with him, I was listening today to the latest episode of Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend podcast, which is dedicated to Norm Macdonald and features a lot of additional contributions from Andy Richter. So,
Yeah, they both knew him for, well, most of their careers. So, all right.
All right. Well, let's
speaking of things that made me really sad. Let's talk about this week. Let's talk about this week's episode, this week's show. Who's doing our intro?
Well, that'd be me because this was a Bryn pick, and I just want to apologize in advance to both of you, and well, not in advance, you know, like I guess apologies for making you guys watch this, and apologies to everyone out there. I chose this show basically because I saw it's a woman-led project, and it's starring like Christine Ebersole, who I've always liked, and it seems like I'm like, oh, it's a diverse cast. Looks great.
There were promising attributes.
Yeah.
For sure.
So basically we covered Rachel Gunn RN. It's a medical comedy, I guess.
That's generous to say medical comedy.
So
set us up here.
Yeah, let's get into it. So Rachel Gunn RN was a Fox sitcom that ran from June to September 1992. A total of 13 episodes were produced, but only 10 of them made it to air. It was created by Catherine Green, a writer and producer of Married with Children, and you can really tell. It was originally intended to air on CBS as a vehicle for country singer KT Osland, but she ultimately dropped out because she thought the character and premise of the show were too mean-spirited. CBS agreed with this, obviously, and kind of gave it over to Fox, where it had a short life, and it's basically the place where crass sitcoms thrived at the time. Christine Ebersole was cast as the titular character, and what's it about? Well, the best way to describe it is it's a dark comedy about the zany staff of Little Innocence Hospital in Nebraska. Rachel Gunn is a sharp-tongued, cynical head nurse just trying to catch a break in life. Her co-workers are an eccentric bunch played by a very talented ensemble, which includes Megan Mullally, Dan Tullis Jr., Brian Brightcloud, Lois Foraker, and Kathleen Mitchell. The bane of Rachel's existence is aging Ken doll and complete asshole, Dr. Dunkel, played by Kevin Conroy. After his divorce, Dr. Dunkel winds up as Rachel's tenant because why not? There is also a strange amount of dancing and a pervy undercurrent to many plots, which was a hallmark of Fox shows at the time. We watched the pilot and episode 8 for this podcast, and I'm still not sure where the show was headed, if anywhere. Critics didn't like this show, but praised Christine Ebersole's performance. Basically, every trade magazine, including Entertainment Weekly and Variety, they panned it immediately. A review from July 1992 by David Hiltbrand for People magazine was particularly harsh. So the article is called Picks and Pans review, Rachel Gunn, RN. You guys can find it online if you want. A couple of fun quotes from it is, Fox is scraping the bottom of the bedpan for this summer sitcom. And he calls it an ugly insult fest as well. It's full of fat phobia, misogyny, racial stereotypes, gay panic, you name it.
Absolutely.
I didn't catch any gay panic, but I was waiting for it because every element of this show is like, well, it's already been racist. It's been sexist. It's been culturally insensitive. I was like, where's the gay panic? It's 1991.
As anyone who listens to this podcast knows, I tend to make a lot of notes when I watch these shows, but I often don't do a lot of research before watching the first episode to know much about the context. And in this case, it was no exception. So when I sat down to watch this, I didn't even know this was on Fox. And so I was definitely caught off guard by the tone of the show. I was expecting, based on like the promo art and the description, like the brief sort of capsule description of the show, I was kind of expecting something with the tone of like Cheers, but set at the nursing station of a hospital. And what I got was like Al Bundy's shoe store, but the nursing station of a hospital.
Yeah.
Like the most sort of, I mean, like those reviews said, just dredging the bottom in terms of like the harshest, but like that super rapid fire style of dialogue that is reminiscent of Married with Children. And why does that show keep coming up when we talk about this stuff?
I mean,
it was seminal for the early 90s.
It was a huge show. It was like, you know, it's iconic. It's very much kind of married, if you will, to that to the 80s and 90s. And obviously, like, you can tell, like, Catherine Green's, like, sensibility that either she already had or developed while working on Married with Children, like, kind of really carried over into this project. Like, it's very horny, as many of the Fox shows were. Like, there's a lot of gross, like, slut shaming of young women. But then there's also an equal amount of like hunky dudes.
I would say more than equal.
Yeah.
I would say it skews much more in that direction, which was weird and interesting for a
like there's like change. Definitely
a lot of beefcake.
A lot of beefcakes. Like straight
a lot
from,
of mimbos.
Right from the like Chippendales stage, you know, like it's like very it's very odd. Like there's literally a moment where Rachel is feeling up a bunch of guys, like she's going up to them and like just like touching their muscles and like drooling over them, and it's completely out of nowhere. Like it's just like she's meeting these guys, and then the one guy starts what's that thing where they like flex their pecs and it moves or whatever. It was
their
just
pecs kind of dance up and down.
It was just weird and out of
the
place.
The old Terry Crews.
It's yucky. It's like very. Like Fabio's in it, and there was another dude who I recognized, and I thought, oh, it might have been Fabio's big rival back then, but then it turned out that it wasn't him. There was like this guy.
Fabio was in this?
Fabio, he did like an episode.
I think two episodes, actually.
Yeah, a couple episodes.
Oh, but not in
the ones we watched.
No, not the ones we watched, but there was.
So there were more episodes that featured beefcakes?
Yes.
And there's like a weird amount of dancing. Like, well, there's so many like dance moments that are random.
Yeah, there's big dance moments in both the episodes we watched. Yeah.
It's interesting. Like, much has been said by us and many others about the particular versions of like idealized body types in certain eras. Like in the early 90s, we've talked a lot about how women were expected to be rail thin, and like sitcoms would have a lot of sort of plot lines around weight loss and things like that. And this show kind of brings up the sort of equal and opposing trope of the male idealized form, which is like the thickest guys you can possibly imagine, where it's like so muscular.
But they're like bodybuilders.
Such big bodybuilders.
And they have that like long hair.
Like oiled up bodybuilders, tanned, oiled up.
It's weird. It's very, very like weird.
WWE type of.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely, it's a Baywatch bod, you know? Yes. Baywatch bods in the 90s were big on male or female, because, you know, real thin and bosomy on one side.
Right.
Yeah.
And giant and also bosomy on the other side.
And also bosomy.
Yeah.
For all the geeks out there who were listening while we were talking about this, I was very excited for this show. Very, very, very excited because it was, as Bryn mentioned, Kevin Conroy was the male lead.
Yeah.
Kevin Conroy being one of the most prolific voice actors of all time, who has famously, since 1992, has been the iconic Batman voice. He is the Batman that every geek hears in their head when they read a Batman comic. There is nobody who's ever done it better than Kevin Conroy. Yeah. And I was so excited. I've only seen him in live action things once or twice, so this was a bit of a treat. And like very weird to hear Bruce Wayne's voice coming out of this man. And he is good.
Yeah, he's good. He's very good. He's good at playing that asshole. Like, you know, like it's well cast. But, you know, like, thanks, Barry, for spoiling the spinoff. But I guess if anyone was going to talk about that, it should be you. So
I can't. Yeah, I cannot go this without talking about how much I love Kevin Conroy and how much I was excited to see him.
It's definitely like a gravelly, like Bruce Wayne, like it's a gravelly, like Batman. It's like a gruff Batman.
For anybody out there who hasn't seen Rachel Gunn
series,
RN. So the speaking voice he uses in Rachel Gunn RN is basically the fake Playboy persona that he uses when he's Bruce Wayne. So it's weird to see that kind of play out in live action. You know, an interesting thing just on this character is you go into this, you get the premise. Oh, you know, she's going to move in with this complete asshole. Obviously there's going to be a will they, won't they somewhere down the line. And you're like, okay, so this is the asshole character. They're going to write this guy to be the biggest asshole in the room. And he is. But was anybody else kind of surprised? And I'm like, oh my God, everybody's somehow so much worse.
Yeah.
Like, she is the biggest asshole in the room. Yeah. She is one of the least pleasant main characters I've ever encountered.
And you know, that's fine. The thing is, like, there is a place for these shows where everyone is a piece of crap. Like, everyone's a terrible person. But like, the things that they say and do are so like bad and offensive that you can't get on their side at all.
And they're
like,
it's not like
Seinfeld. It's not like the Seinfeld characters where they're all terrible. It's beyond redeeming.
It's just mean.
Yeah.
And the show is on their side. And also none of them like each other. So it's really unpleasant to be around because all it is constant. Like, we watched the first episode and the eighth episode. And in the eighth episode, she was still making the exact same jokes to the asshole doctor, because clearly the show has no interest in characters. It was just like, people are going to be mean to each other for 30 minutes every week, and that's it.
Yeah, and they're going to basically abuse their patients.
Yeah, I mean, shows that do characters like this, you know, who can sometimes be mean or unlikable, that do it well, it's because those characters are selfish or arrogant, or they have their character flaws and they act out on those character flaws, and we see the results in the dialogue. But this show feels like it's just a nonstop run of punching down mean-spirited one-liners that are not like revealing anything about who these people are or what their personalities are actually like. There's no relationships that are growing here. It's just, it almost feels like you can see the script page and they're like, punch it up, punch it up again, punch it up, squeeze more jokes in. It's like, there were some scenes, especially by like episode 8, where every line is a joke. And I like when shows do that well, but like when you have 12 jokes a page and maybe one of them is funny, it just starts to feel like this relentless onslaught.
They're all first draft jokes.
Yeah.
In
the pilot, I think one of my only laughs in the pilot was, Kevin Conroy comes down and he's like, oh, you know, my patient's going into post-op. And then, you know, Rachel is like, oh, post-op, one of your patients made it to post-op. I guess that means you have to read the next chapter in the book. And I was like, haha, that's kind of funny. They then went and made the exact same joke about all of his patients dying about 40 more times.
Right. Yeah. It's the same. It's just variations of the same joke. And like the whole dynamic between them, like his comeback to her is always something about her appearance. It's always like, you're old and ugly. And it's like, meanwhile, she's not like a very attractive woman, but because she happens to be like over, you know, I don't know how old she is in here, but she's like, just, you know, she's not 25. So she's old.
I would say she's 42 and the show treats her like she's pushing 60.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really, it's gross. It's really, really gross. Like it's just like he made, and they're awkward jokes too. Like there was that joke when they're driving in the car where he's like, where's the function to, you know, change your boobs from sag, to prevent your boobs from sagging. And he's like referencing
real reach. It was a real reach.
Yeah, it was a real reach. It was like something about, because the car has all these weird functions for some reason.
Okay, speaking of which, there's actually, this is getting ahead to episode 8, but I have to say, like, this one's nagging at me. One of those functions in the car is an ejection seat button where
we all knew there was an ejector seat coming.
But like, here's the thing. There were like jokes about, does this car do this or that, that are like obviously not things that the car does, but just like cracking jokes. Then there's the things that the car does have that are like realistic functions, like things that are attainable. Like, you know, she hits the lever that makes the seat swing back so that he falls back down into a lying down position.
Like the net launcher?
The net falling from the ceiling makes no sense why that would be there, but you could do that. Like, it still is it's a stupid thing to do. It doesn't make sense why the car would have that function, but it exists in a real world. What I'm getting at is that the final payoff is an ejection seat that launches him through the roof out of the car, which obviously would kill him. I mean, a completely cartoon move that this show at no point establishes any motif of ongoing surrealism. There's no world in which this show has things like that happen.
In the two episodes we saw, this was not a constant threat.
No.
So it was very surprising.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it was great because we ended with episode 8, and in episode 8, she presses, you know, the button and he launches through the car roof in an ejector seat and dies. And then we can presume that she went to jail for the rest of her life. Really, the series ends very satisfactorily to me. Like, it was nice to see both of them get their comeuppance, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, apparently there was 5 more episodes after that. Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly didn't care enough to like look into the further episodes and what their plan was. I'm not convinced there was a plan. Like, I don't think
the rest of the 5 were a trial.
I mean, I just feel, I feel like the whole thing is like the fact that they underused Megan Mullally. Like, Megan Mullally's character was like completely miscast.
Wow. They didn't know. Nobody knew. They didn't know what they had yet.
Yeah, I guess nobody knew.
She was a non-entity.
Like, she could have played Rachel Gunn. Like, she could have played that same character. But anyway.
Yeah, Megan Mullally has a way of making mean fun. Like,
right.
Like, yes, that's true.
That's been kind of her brand, is playing these kind of like unhinged, like, you know, sort of bad women, like problematic faves, you know.
Now, when we say that this show is mean, like, a good example of this is that scene in the hospital room where there's a patient who is like a overweight man, if we want to say it that way, where they're basically turning a whole scene into just Rachel and what even is the doctor's name?
David Dunkel.
Batman.
Yeah.
Batman, where Rachel and Batman are just nonstop riffing on this patient's weight.
Yeah.
Right in front of the guy. And it's like nonstop. It's not even like on Married with Children when Al Bundy would make the worst sort of fat shaming jokes. It's a joke. It's not the
it's
entire.
Not good, but it's,
it's not good, but it's not the entire scene. This was, you know, 3-4 minutes of just that. It's crazy. Like my, I was aghast. This show had such a nonstop onslaught of offensive jokes. I was aghast.
Yeah, it's not.
It was very,
And it's not one of those things where it's like, okay, they're super offensive and the joke becomes like, it's almost like we're supposed to be on their side. Whereas like there's other series and other movies where the same thing is happening, but it's clear that the joke is that, oh, they're horrible. You're on everyone else's side.
To use the Al Bundy example, we're not supposed to be on Al's side. We recognize him as being a despicable guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She is supposed to be a sort of heroic, typical protagonist.
This is not to say that, like, obviously you can write women that are like bad people and like, you know, but there's just a way to do it. Like there's
That is not the issue here at all. It has nothing to do with her being a woman. It has everything with this being a very mean-spirited written thing. And I think a good example of all this would be like, you know, the one I keep coming back to would be, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
They're always, you know, they're very mean, but generally, you know, there's a good natured humor to a lot of it. But one of the things I can think of is the way that the gang treats Sweet D. They're very, very mean to her repeatedly with like just absolutely
like
over the top bad. But for the most part, we understand that when they're making fun of her appearance or anything like that, we know as an audience that Caitlin Olsen is a very, you know, beautiful woman and like, these exaggerated things they're saying, the joke is on them.
Yeah, because they're being nonsensical.
Right?
Yeah.
So the
maybe
way
that's what they were going for with this, but it just doesn't work the same way. I don't know.
No, it's all punching down. It doesn't work because I'll tell you why it doesn't work. It doesn't work because it's not funny.
Yeah.
That's why it doesn't work. It's not funny. If you can tell that a writer has a prejudice in their jokes, like these are the kind of writers who would, you know, get upset if somebody was like, well, I can joke about anything I want, make it funny. And it's like, not if it's not funny. Like making a joke doesn't automatically make it funny. Making a funny joke makes a funny joke.
Yeah.
So these are all bad. Like the way I imagine all of these characters, none of the characters like each other in this show. They're all miserable to each other. They're miserable to be around. It's nothing but 30 minutes of nonstop barbs back and forth. Mm-hmm. This is like if Seinfeld was just scenes between Jerry and Newman.
it kind of is. Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of antagonism and it feels like probably what if hell exists, that would be like where you just don't like anyone that you're surrounded by. On a daily basis. And
so speaking of antagonism, one of the things I noticed that's certainly the case in this show, but it seems to be maybe like a Fox trope, especially, is this sitcom world, sitcom land, where there's a constant war between men and women.
Yes.
It's misogynist, but also it seems to be positioned almost as if it's like, someone read the title of that famous book, like Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus or whatever. And just without even reading the book was like, that will be how we define our entire TV network. So it's like, like this battle between men and women who can't get along, who can't be friends, who can't have positive relationships with each other, even down to like the basic setup off the top of this doctor who has apparently, we learned, just gotten divorced. And the way he talks about that is in that sort of typical 80s, early 90s stand-up comics sort of like really despises women and despises the idea of marriage and is just so, and speaks mm-hmm. about, you know, the whole idea that he's moving in as a tenant in the nurse's duplex is because his ex-wife took all his money, and he's just like constantly whining about that. And it's just like that yeah. whole antagonism, that ongoing
it's idea. 1990, it's 1991 yeah. and they're treating it like it's the Honeymooners. Like,
yes.
You know, like,
yeah.
Also, it's not what a duplex is.
No, sorry. It's not.
That's not how duplexes are laid out. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
No, that was a large, lavish suburban home that for some reason they called it duplex because it had like a second door. The other thing I should say, you know, like speaking of my own sort of learning curve on sitcom history, is that before we started doing this podcast together, I don't think I was as aware as the two of you on the implications of shows coming from one network or another. And like, yeah. we've talked in the past about how I didn't really know much about what TGIF was, but like, I'm only kind of through the course of our podcast learning that Fox shows tended to be the sort of cruder, more, yeah. Yeah. more R-rated comedies, and NBC would be like the more adult comedies, and ABC would be the more family or child friendly comedies. And like the way that each of these networks somehow had their lane is something that's pretty new to me.
And CBS made shows for people who left the TV on all night.
Yeah, like the thing about CBS is like, it's hard to pinpoint their sort of brand. Like, I feel like it's skewed older. Like I do think it's skewed like toward like, you know, more kind of like suburban, like older audiences. Yeah. But there's nothing that's that defining about it. Whereas like the other ones are such a like clear thing, you know, CBS or like ABC was like family friendly or working class.
CBS is dominated by Chuck Lorre now, right?
Right.
For the last
yeah.
20 yeah. something
but
years.
In
so
the 90s, it was hard
they,
to
They hadn't really found a niche. They're probably yeah. like their first major hit was like Everybody Loves Raymond.
Hmm.
Which, yeah, I mean, which kind of goes along with the
and what,
more of the ABC type of model.
And what network was Full House on?
ABC.
Okay, that's what
ABC.
I thought.
Yeah.
So episode 8, of
Family
course,
Matters
begins.
Was ABC, like.
Episode 8 begins with the audio of a TV news report that you're hearing over
God.
Like the house exterior or whatever. That's just yeah. like major shots fired at Full House.
Yeah.
Well, it's just the joke was they were doing a Senate hearing to determine how Full House had been on the air for 7 years without having a single joke.
But it's
and
like,
I was like,
what,
that's
you
a
think
funny,
you're
that's
that
a-
much funnier? Like,
yeah, I was like, that's a funny joke, guys. You don't deserve to tell it.
Yeah,
exactly. They might have a larger quantity of what
jokes.
Could technically
yeah.
be described on paper as jokes. It's just none of them were funny.
Yeah. Jokes, 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 jokes. I don't know, man. It was, it was kind of exhausting. Like, I like Christine Ebersole a lot, and I will still kind of stan her, even though this show is trash.
I really dislike her in this.
Yeah.
Like, a lot.
But everybody, there's not much to like, sadly. Like, there is, like... Yeah,
I mean, I also don't care for her performance. She's the biggest one in a crowd of people going way too big.
Right. Yeah,
like,
that's fair.
Mullally has moments, you know, Conroy has moments.
But the whole style
yeah.
is very self-aware. You're seeing actors kind of prancing around on stage. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
putting their constant run of jokes out there as if they're doing some sort of like, I don't know, it's like a...
Oh, it's in front of an audience.
It's in front of an audience, but it's very like self-aware of like, my turn to talk, joke, joke, joke. Now it's my turn to talk, joke, joke, joke. And it's very like aware of itself. They're all kind of putting on that show. And it's almost like watching like a tennis match where they're batting the ball back and forth, you know, joke, 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 none of which have laughs,
well,
but just
yeah,
line.
It's sitcom acting, right? But it's also the good ones know how to find a character in there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, in the
I don't think these ones do.
The good sitcom acting is bigger than a drama where characters are, you know, portrayed by actors who are completely in the moment and like not aware of an audience. But at the same time, like usually they get lost in the scene. Like usually, you know, I don't know, as an example of a show with rapid fire dialogue that, you know, works, you can look at shows like Cheers and Frasier of the time. And, you know, if Frasier and Niles are exchanging one-liners, Frasier's talking to Niles, Niles is talking to Frasier. They're going a little bit bigger than two real human beings would be in a living room, but they are talking to each other and you can perceive that relationship between them. Whereas this is all for the benefit of the audience. This is
What I'm saying is the difference is you find a character, right? They're all playing for an audience. They're all going big. They're all doing that. But on something like Frasier, they're playing characters and it doesn't matter if the audience laughs because they're in the scene. Whereas in this one, like they're going to stop shooting if nobody's laughing. That's what it feels like. They're like, laugh.
Yeah.
I want to call out a trope that I identified in the pilot that I'm surprised that I don't think we've ever talked about before, to add to the oeuvre of things like bowling and country clubs, is the weekly poker game around a kitchen table trope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which this show had. And whenever sitcoms have this, there's rarely any like setup. It's always just assumed, like you can just sort of hard cut from like people at work to it's the evening and they're all sitting around the kitchen table playing poker. And it's almost like, is that the shorthand to say, these are people who like hanging out with each other in real life outside of work? It's always poker.
The one thing I'll say is that I thought it was nice to see that it was like a bunch of women meeting to play poker. I thought that was fun.
I also found it weird because I'm like, in the last scene, I was under the impression none of you liked each other.
Exactly.
So it didn't feel earned at all.
It didn't. You're right.
It felt just wedged in there.
Yeah.
I mean, even Star Trek The Next Generation had this. Every show from the time had a poker game.
The dietitian was there and they clearly don't like her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very strange.
That whole part of the show, like the fact that she's a dietitian that is not good at her job. And like, it was really silly. It was really.
Oh, the whole thing is really
like, there's
weird.
Just like all of the characters have like a quirk and it's
and
just
that's it.
And that, yeah, and yeah, they're one note,
but they're each there to be that, you know, that archetype or that purpose. There's the nun. There's the, of course, the like indigenous man who's a nurse, and all they do is like relentless offensive jokes there.
Yeah, it's really bad. It's really bad. I was like, ooh, this is not good.
Yeah, all of the diversity of the show that seemed promising before we watched it is, just horrifyingly undone by the way that they treat these characters and these actors. And also, this is a very minor thing, but her home, this really bothered me. Her home, like the way it's decorated, she's like supposed to be this single woman with no kids. And her home looks like it was borrowed from a cliche family sitcom that would be populated by a family of five.
Right. Wasn't there something to that, though? Wasn't it like an inherited house or something?
Well, yeah, it was originally like a house that belonged to her parents. But it just doesn't make sense that like a woman in her 40s.
It was just lazy set.
Yeah, it was just lazy.
Just like the hospital sets were lazy. Everything was lazy.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a medical show where they did they did all their background medical research by reading back issues of Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
They weren't really going for realism on this one.
No.
Also, like, did nurses actually wear those like white dress uniforms by the 90s?
you know, no one knows. Television tells us they did.
Television says they did. And like in the very like the opening scenes of the pilot, there's that whole beat where there's the like hot young nurse wearing like an impossibly tiny like nurse dress.
I mean, it's the Halloween costume nurse dress.
Yeah, it's basically like
costume is by Party Town.
Yeah, it's like the sexy nurse Halloween costume in real life, and she's got like all the cleavage and like I have to say like a very great like 90s perm. I was like wow, look at those curls.
I didn't know where you're going with that sentence.
I was like, oh, like, it's so voluminous. And so like, it looked like the poster from, you know, any 90s hair salon. Like it was very, you know, but of course she's like it's basically they took one of the women that was like bimbo number three from like a Married with Children episode. And they put her in this show, and like obviously in real life she's probably not a bimbo, but like it's basically like she's there for the women who are older to slut shame and the doctor to be inquiring about later on, and as like a pervy
and this was the scene that they opened the series with.
Yeah, that was like what they set the tone with, is like them like slut shaming, and she like literally like Rachel Gunn like literally like launches her out of the she like kicks her off the floor.
She assaults her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Assaults her and fires her.
She like pushes her into the elevator.
She doesn't fire her.
No. There's an implication in the dialogue that she's fired.
It says that she's fired.
Yeah.
How? No, because he later brings up that she was transferred to another floor.
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Well,
it's sloppy. It's all sloppy.
It's sloppy. I mean, he's a surgeon, but then he's an obstetrics, and then he's like an ER doctor.
He's just a generic doctor.
Yeah.
That opening scene that was clearly just a vehicle to have cleavage.
That moment was there for her to be super, super mean to her. That's why they wanted people to be like, see, we're not like the other shows. We're mean.
I guess.
I hate it. That was about that time is when I wrote in my notes, Jesus Christ, I hate this show.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't take long.
I wrote in my notes, what is happening with Thor and his muscular buddies?
Yeah. Well, it's his family members. Thor.
Yeah, they were family.
To explain to everyone, Thor is like the first hunk that we meet. That basically inquires about Rachel's duplex to like rent it out. So Rachel is looking for a new tenant because the little old lady that lived there dropped dead, and they make all kinds of jokes about that, which is gross. And apparently every like older person who lived in her duplex has died. And so she has this like constant turnover of tenants. And so at the beginning of the series, she's trying to find a new tenant, like Dr. Dunkel. She's hesitant, but she ultimately agrees to let him live there. And then Thor comes walking in, and she's like drooling over him. And he's like, oh, is your duplex still available? And she's like immediately like regretful that she said Dunkel can move in. And is like trying to like hit on him and get him to like.
It's such a horny show that after her first encounter talking to him, she dumps cold water down the front of her uniform.
Yeah. it's really dumb. And then, at some point, Thor starts moving in, and he brings like his brothers or his like. He says it's his family, but it's like a bunch of other big like bodybuilder guys. And so this is the scene we referenced earlier where she's basically walking up and molesting them all. And like they're just standing there. And
yeah, but I mean, it almost plays out like going to what's that famous male stripper?
Chippendales. I mentioned it already. Yeah,
it's kind of like she paid for a multi-person lap dance from a bunch of Chippendales dancers.
Yeah.
They really make a big set piece out of this scene.
Yeah.
My favorite bit of acting in the pilot actually comes in that scene where, like, in no way was it necessary? But Kevin Conroy in the background of that scene, as they're going guy to guy, has like so much appreciation for the men. And I was just like, oh my God, I love what he's doing with his face here. Like, he's like looking them up and down. He's like, great.
yeah,
doesn't need
that.
To be there. Doesn't need to be there, but he's impressed. He's very impressed.
He's like, touche, guys. I get it.
Yeah. At the end of the day, this show had a lot less comedy based on the job of a nurse than I was expecting.
Yeah.
And a lot more based on dancing than I was expecting.
Like, yeah.
Which brings us to a good trope. The dance contest.
Yeah. I mean,
the dance contest is a big feature in sitcoms.
It's a staple of any like 80s, 90s sitcom. Like, especially, there's always a dance scene.
There is. And especially what they did in this one, where one of the main characters is going out to a dance contest and it turns out to be the wrong type of dancing.
Yeah. So basically, they're both short on cash. And by they, I mean Rachel and David Dunkel, they're both short on cash a particular month, and they need to like make the mortgage payment, the rent payment, etc. And they decide that they're going to enter a dance competition together. And it's complete nonsense. And they start practicing. They start practicing like for a tango type of ballroom tango dancing. And they're doing it in the hospital, and it's like a whole thing. It's very, very silly. And then ultimately, when the day of the contest arrives, they realize that there's another contest that's a bit farther away.
But it pays more money.
But it pays more money. The payout would be bigger. So they decide, oh, we're going to like, you know, we're going to go to this one instead. And then it turns out to be like kind of like a young, like hip hop style dancing. And they're dressed to tango, which is completely absurd. It's like these very, very silly, over the top costumes, which is like, where would they get them? Like, did they even say?
No.
No, they're just out of the old tickle trunk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're so desperate for money that they're spending money renting or buying these elaborate costumes.
And they show up, and then it's their moment to sort of do their dance. And I have to say,
It's good physical comedy.
Yeah, they do a good job dancing badly. Like, there's no ounce of like rhythm at all. Like, they're literally just kind of flailing around.
It actually, a lot of the dancing in this episode, it brought out some of the only bits. There was a glimmer of a show in there where I was just like, when these characters are not, when they were not being terrible to each other, and like they actually managed to have just a tiny bit of chemistry in their dancing scenes. And I was just like, see, if these two were like scheming and they were on the same side, I might be able to get behind the show at times. Like, where I was like, they're mean, but like, because it was just constant barrage of insults, like you never get a chance. But I was like, all right, well, if these two were on the same side, the show could work.
Yeah, totally. Because a good sort of basis for comedy in a show like this would be the sort of old saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, where you take a couple of characters who are sort of foils for each other most of the time, but you have an ongoing thing where they sometimes join forces to take on some sort of institutional villain or bigger sort of challenge that comes up in the plot, where people who often bicker can kind of work together to like take on the world. And when TV shows or movies do that well, that makes for like really good character development. This show shows a shred of that just in that dancing scene, but never anywhere else.
No.
The other thing that really pisses me off is like, I don't know, they do a good job in the case of Rachel as a nurse who's kind of struggling to make money, because nurses are chronically underpaid in the real world.
Yeah.
And so they establish that like she lives in a nice house, but she inherited it from her parents. And she's always kind of struggling to make ends meet. And it makes sense that when she needs, like an emergency comes up and she needs $500 or whatever, that she's scrounging to get the money, or that she's renting part of her house out to a tenant. But the doctor, having like not $300 to his name.
No, but he lost everything in his divorce. And he was constantly paying more.
There
was that stupid joke about how he has to pay child support for his ex-wife's inner child.
Yeah. But that
wounded inner child.
But what I'm getting at is like, that's all. Yes, they talk. They set up all of those justifications for it so that they can like explain away why he would need to like rent out of her house as a place to live, or why he would need to scrounge for $500. So yes, they have all of that dialogue and all that business to explain why he's in that situation. But really, at the end of the day, what they're doing is they're trying to make a character that in the real world would probably make a lot of money, and trying to make him relatable for a working class audience. So they're trying to like build all of this backstory around him to kind of take him down a page socioeconomically so that he can be on the same level as the other characters. But in the real world, that probably wouldn't be the case. And he would not be renting a room in her house, and he would not be entering a dance contest to make a few $100.
I mean, unless he were like a resident or something, because then that's...
Well, then you'd have something.
When they're not like an established...
I would say in the universe of the show, I bought his money problems more than I bought hers. Because she is very established at that hospital.
She's the head nurse.
She's
to be
deep
fair.
Into her career. Yeah. She lists off her degrees.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think their intent was that she was a low paid nurse. Like,
true. And
I just
also
don't think they know. I just don't think they know what they're doing.
Yeah, no, I think that's what it is, really. At the end of the like, it seems like there's supposed to be some sort of commentary, but it's like it's confusing. Like, it's a lot of contradicting and like lots of, I don't know. It's weird.
But again, like, it's one of those sitcoms that exists in that sitcom world, like Married with Children or Roseanne, where it's kind of crude and kind of trying to appeal to a certain type of audience that wants to see people who are not, you know, the rich, successful, upper middle class people, professionals in a suburb like a lot of other sitcoms would have. Mm-hmm. So it feels like they're just trying to find excuses for why this mature head nurse and this mature doctor are struggling to like make ends meet and struggling to find a few $100. And
They just got to get into the dance contest.
Yeah, they do. They just have to find a way.
So, Bryn, how would you like to connect Rachel Gunn RN to Friends for us?
Yeah, why not? Let's do this. Rachel Gunn RN is separated from Friends by 2 degrees. So it goes like this. Megan Mullally, who played Becky Jo on Rachel Gunn RN, guest starred on Mad About You.
Oh, no.
You've been banned from this.
I don't care. It's so fun to watch your reactions. So Megan Mullally guest starred on Mad About You, which co-starred Lisa Kudrow as Ursula Buffet. And as you know...
No, we don't know. Please, please explain.
Lisa Kudrow played the other Buffet, the more famous Buffet, Phoebe Buffet in Friends.
Sigh. But actually, I am kind of curious now about Megan Mullally's guest starring role on Mad About You. Do you know what kind of character it was?
I didn't get into it.
None of the three of us watched any Mad About You. Yeah. Much Mad About You.
I did as a kid. I used to watch the reruns a lot.
It came on.
I didn't watch it independently, but my parents watched a lot of Mad About You, so it was just like on in my house a lot. So I certainly like caught a lot of scenes, but I don't really have much memory.
I had seen enough of it that I always associated it with like a form of comedy that was just pretty much just like giving up, which is why that joke of George and Susan watching it on Seinfeld landed big for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think I watched it because I liked those sitcoms that were set in New York City. It seemed so like exotic to me as a kid who grew up in a rural area. Like, it was very appealing to me to watch shows set in New York where people lived in apartment buildings and stuff. I found it really exciting back then.
Everybody has that. That's why there's so many.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just familiar with it enough that that joke in Seinfeld is one of my favorite all-time jokes in all of Seinfeld. Every just time
the theme,
I watch
just
it.
The theme, song playing and nothing else over the credits while they're watching it is just amazing.
And the fact that, and it's very different from a show like Rachel Gunn making fun of Full House, because in this case, it's not actually saying that there's anything wrong with Mad About You. In fact, Mad About You was on NBC at this, like, with a lot of overlap at the same time as Seinfeld.
It would lead into Seinfeld.
Friends was 8. Mad About You was 8:30. Seinfeld was 9.
Yeah. And there was like crossover in that world. Yeah. And it's just kind of the idea that Mad About You is the show for the people who've settled down and gotten married. Yeah. And Seinfeld is the show for the people who are like perpetually, you know, fighting against adulting, basically.
It's funny how all of that lineup for must-see TV was like New York set shows.
9:30 was Frasier, so Seattle.
Oh, Seattle. Okay, yeah. So there's one outlier there. All right. Enough about that. Enough about Mad About You.
Apparently, you can never get enough about Mad About You.
I'm mad about it.
What of the spinoff?
To be honest with you, it was pretty straightforward. I mean, most of the supporting cast, unfortunately, didn't really do too much. Like, they kind of worked on and off throughout the 90s. Christine Ebersole continued to share her talents with the world, co-starring in a lot of films and TV shows. Recent credits of hers that I really liked were Mariel Davenport, Portia Davenport's mother on Search Party. Right now, she's also on the show Bob Hart's Abishola. I don't know if you guys have seen that. I don't know. It's the role of Dottie. And she's also on the Kominsky Method right now. She's just iconic. She's just one of those women that you've seen in television for years and years and years. Like, she's in everything. She's always like on fire, in my opinion. Like, she's always like excellent. And then, as Barry already alluded to, after his stint, well, actually didn't allude, he like
explicitly laid out.
Kevin Conroy, soon after his stint on Rachel Gunn RN, he became the voice of Batman, and that is like basically what he's most well known for. Megan Mullally, of course, is probably the biggest star to emerge out of this cast, although she was completely underused in this show. In 98, she went on to be in Will and Grace, which is kind of the thing that like launched her career in a big way. She played Karen. After Will and Grace, she went on to play many memorable roles in TV comedies. She became known for playing kind of zany women that were kind of mercurial, or, you know, just you know what to expect when she would show up in something. One of my favorite roles of hers is Lydia Dunfree on Party Down.
Oh, yeah.
The kind of like naive Midwestern stage mom who named her daughter Escapade, which I think is like incredible. And she also played Tammy, too, in Parks and Rec.
Oh, yeah. That was a good
one. That was a very fun role.
I'm rewatching that right now.
With her like real life husband, Nick Offerman. The show's creator, Catherine Green, she continued to work as a writer and producer on a few other series, including The Drew Carey Show and My Wife and Kids. Her IMDb credits don't go past 2006, but my guess is because she retired, because she had been at it since the late 70s. Yeah, that's about it.
And didn't we see Jonathan Wolf in the end credits?
Oh, yes, I forgot. Yes, our pal, friend of the pod, Jonathan Wolf, worked on this show. So
I randomly messaged him about it.
Nice.
So that's what happened here. That was Rachel Gunn RN. Woo!
We might as well give a call to our our buddy, friend of the pod.
Another friend of the pod.
Mr. Producer, perhaps, and see if...
Is he a friend or is he an antagonist? Is he like our frenemy at this point?
I think he's a friend.
I feel like he's almost like a confidential informant.
Aaron Yeager, my friend. How are you?
Oh, hello, Mr. Producer.
What?
Nothing. You just usually don't answer the phone so cheerfully. You're usually way more confused.
Oh, yeah. Well, my grandson, Milo, he got me a new phone. It's got the who's calling you identification. What an invention. Do you have one of those?
Caller ID? Yeah, I've got caller ID.
Way of the future, kid. So what are we talking about this week?
Rachel Gunn, RN.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You've heard of it then?
Oh, yeah, I remember. You know, it was a little bit crass for my liking.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it just seemed a little mean, you know, a little sexist. Some culturally insensitive jokes tossed about a bit too freely for my tastes.
Oh, wow. Well, it's a bit surprising to hear you say that.
Surprising?
Well, I mean, you're a bit rough sometimes.
Hey, I've got some edges, sure. You know, maybe in this town, you might even say I got a bit of a reputation. You know, they say that producer, he's a fast-talking, hard-drinking, do-anything-if-the-money's-right SOB. But, you know, I do have my standards.
You do?
Ah, sure, if the money ain't right.
Of course. Well, I hope I didn't offend you suggesting otherwise.
Ah, of course not, Aaron. You're a good boy. You're like family to me. You and that wonderful wife of yours. That Helmer kid, I could do without.
Hey, what'd I do?
You know what you did, you smug bastard.
Hey, but I...
That's not the time for it. But now let's just say I do not like the clap of your slate. Gotta run, guys.
So does anyone have any leftovers? I mean, I have a note that just says, this was wow.
One of my notes is just completely nonsensical. But if you've seen the opening credits of this, that's not how elevators work, you kooky nun. Because she walks in and then walks out and walks in again. Like, what was the staging of that? What did they think that was? And why was that in the opening credits? Also, did you guys notice, and I didn't put the effort in to watch more than the two episodes, but did you guys notice that they had like a couch gag in the opening credits?
Yes, I did. I did actually find that kind of cute. How they would, like, yeah, they had a gag at the end of every theme song where they were all heading in the same direction. And in the first episode, it was them all like eating pizza with the pizza box on a patient. That was maybe
no,
dead.
It was a dummy. Ruse to get together in the room.
Yeah, and then in the other episode that we watched, it was them with like Nerf guns ready to shoot the doctor. So
they had target practice of him on
right.
the wall.
Oh, target practice with him on the wall. But then when he walked in the room, they turned the gun on.
They got him.
So yeah, that was kind of cute.
Do you call that a couch gag because it's a Simpsons reference?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a couch gag.
I didn't know that expression.
Well, it's a couch, you know, and you see it pops up in a lot of animated shows do couch gags now. Like American Dad has a couch gag where Roger pops out of the car in a different outfit. You know, write in and tell us your favorite couch gags, everybody.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, that was a show. Cut to credits. That Was a Show is created and hosted by Bryn Burney, Andrew Barry Helmer, and myself, Aaron Yeager. It's a production of Radio Gizmo in Toronto, Canada. Subscribe, rate, review, and share. Follow us on Instagram and tell your friends about it. That Was a Show?
Radio Gizmo.